Welcome to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Your host, Carl Nordgren, will teach you how to take an expansive view on what it means to be creative and entrepreneurial. Carl is an entrepreneur, novelist, and a lifelong student. For 20 years, he has been learning how to help folks grow their creative capacities. Now, here's Carl.
Hello and welcome. Happy Sunday. I hope it's a wonderful Sunday that you're having. This is Carl Nordgren. You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius on 97.9 The Hill, WCHL. What a wonderful station they are, serving this wonderful community. The show, as you heard in the introduction, takes an expansive view on what it means to be creative and entrepreneurial. It does so because it's by far the best for you if you create your own understanding of what it means to be creative and entrepreneurial in your life. And so I give you lots of different concepts and ideas and voices, lots of guests who share their thoughts about creativity from lots of different angles so that you can craft the understanding of creativity that serves you best. Today, and I did this about a half a year ago, I'm going to take this extensive view and I'm going to extend this work into what? Maybe sparking our political imaginations. Once upon a time, we had wonderful political imaginations. 15,000 years ago, our ancestors really understood the dynamics of living together in community. And these examples I'm going to share with you folks have been found in the last four or five decades from about 15,000 years ago in communities that got quite large, right? It's easy to dismiss this by saying, oh, well, it's small populations. No, some of these communities got up to be 250,000 people. And so what am I admiring in their political imagination? The following. Here's a simple version of it. Where they got this large, where these communities, our ancestors' communities got this large, and this is from all around the world, folks, indigenous populations all around the world, where their populations got large enough that something like a police force became a good idea, here's what they did so very, very frequently. Lots of evidence that this happened in lots of places differently each time, but here's the fundamental idea. The police force's tenure was very short. Maybe it was just a few months, 6 months. And that meant that the power, let's say I'm a policeman, the power that I have that I can exercise for the 6 months in making sure that the community stays within the boundaries, right, the rules, the mores of what we want our community to be, I lose that job after about 6 months. That power that I had transfers to one of my neighbors, one of my villagers. And so won't that just inevitably have a restraint on how I exercise my power? I certainly will be disinclined to abuse my power if I know I'm going to be handing it over to somebody who will have that same power to abuse me. Isn't that marvelous? In some of the places, there's even a more complex version of this. And in communities that were reliant on a peak protein, right, a big spike in available protein, and boy, much of their year's diet depended on their effective and efficient harvesting of that protein. Is it salmon run up in the Northwest? Is it big nut harvests in Europe? And here's another example. There would often be, for that peak period of time, right? For that peak period where we have to be really efficient in getting all this protein that we can because our lives depend upon it, there's lots of evidence of communities establishing, in effect, a dictator during that season, during that peak protein season, a dictator with a police force who are making sure that everybody understands their job, making sure that they're doing their job, making sure that they're doing it efficiently so we can maximize the capture of salmon, so we can maximize the collection of nuts. And excuse me, as soon as that season of peak harvest was over, the dictator's job was gone. All that authority was dismantled. And now leadership through the rest of the year was a persuasive leadership. Here's a challenge. Here's an idea. Who's got the best voice? So I'm looking for us. I mean, we are so wonderfully creative. Let's start to use our creative thinking, our imaginative thinking more in politics. And I hope some of this will prompt us a little bit. Let's remember, first of all, one of the main messages that I try to deliver in this show is the extraordinary creative qualities we're all born with. The research that NASA participated in is just one example of making this case that we found that 98% of five-year-old school children, 98% score at NASA's creative genius level on the same assessment tool that NASA uses in their organization. When I share that with folks, and I have shared that with folks over the last 20 years, probably some more than 15,000 people have heard this. I know for a fact, folks, that this common ground, 98%, and can there be a bigger piece of common ground, right? What other quality does more than 98% of us share? That this common ground, that we're all born creative geniuses, I know for a fact that you will find that this is as attractive to the left as it is to the right. That says a lot about that piece of common ground, that it is as attractive and important to folks who already have as it is to folks who don't have yet. That's as useful for people in rural settings as it is for people in urban settings. We forget about rural folks, right? My sense of rural folks is that they really aren't concerned about losing things that they value. They're afraid of losing their own sense of value. Well, on this common ground, we all have value and we all have the same value. And this is useful for folks that are well along their life's trip like I am, but even more useful for young folks who are going to be living to the end of this century, this common ground, this embrace of our natural creative qualities. On that common ground, we find the most rational and optimistic story about our future of unknowable unknowns. We find that on our common ground. It's rooted in our common ground. It's a rational story because it's clear that when we're facing unknowable unknowns, that being our most creative and entrepreneurial version of ourselves is the most effective way to prepare for whatever we find in this unpredictable future. And it's optimistic because it plays to our strengths. To build our creative and entrepreneurial qualities to face the future is to play to our strengths. We're born with remarkable creative and entrepreneurial qualities. So this work that I've been doing to help individuals with no political interest at all for much of my 25 years, that this work I'm finding in the last year or two could be really very useful in helping spark our political imaginations, because, boy, we sure need a renewal of our political imaginations. And I'm going to share some examples of that with you when we come on back from the break. Thanks.
You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius with Carl Nordgren. Welcome back to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Here's your host, Carl Nordgren.
Welcome back. Thanks for coming back. I'm Carl Nordgren. You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius. And in the first segment, I set up some historical background to make the point that, folks, we have amazing, amazing political imaginations in our past. It's time for us to bring that wonderful creative thinking back to how we organize ourselves and why we organize ourselves the way we do. And I'm promoting the idea that the creative and entrepreneurial principles and practices associated with creative populism that I've been sharing with you in this show, identifies this extraordinary common ground that 98% of us share, and identifies this wonderful story about how we can prepare ourselves for the future. Well, here's some other places this influences the way we think about issues. I am really captivated by the concept of commonwealth. I know I've relied on commonwealth all throughout my life without being aware of it much of the time. Commonwealth is not some underhanded effort to bring socialism into the conversation. Here's what commonwealth is. Here's where I always start describing commonwealth, and that is, imagine you're talking to 10 first-time entrepreneurs, and you give them this choice. They can either go start their company all by themselves, or they can come into this incubator, this new startup incubator, where they will bring their skills, their knowledge, their contacts, their resources, and the other nine founders will bring theirs, and they will share those. They'll collect those together, and they'll share that, right? It's good for all of them, and it's good for each of them when they come into this incubator. I'll bet you most of the time, 10 out of 10 will say, yeah, let's get in that incubator. So there's a first example of Commonwealth. Here's another, and this is a really fun one for me. I can pretend to be an Illinois farm boy, and so this is all about an Illinois corn farmer. He'd won the blue ribbon in his county for the very best sweet corn 5 years in a row. And after that fifth victory, he attracted the attention of a local small town journalist who came out and said, hey, what's the secret to your success? How have you won this blue ribbon for the best sweet corn 5 years in a row? And the farmer said, well, sir, it's simple. At the end of every harvest, at the end of this year's harvest, I'll collect this corn that I'm setting aside for seed corn, the very best for the seed corn, and I share much of it with the farmers around me. I give it to them, the farmers whose fields abut mine. I share my best seed corn with them. And the journalist said, whoa, wait a minute. Why would you do that? Why would you be helping potential competitors? And the farmer said, sir, you got to understand that when the breezes begin to blow and the wind floats the pollen from the other fields into my field and pollinates my crop, the best way to make sure that I continue to improve is to help my neighbors improve. The best way for me to continue to improve is to help my neighbors improve. Wonderful example of Commonwealth. A third that just boggles my mind, it was labeled socialism at the time, back when FDR was trying to put our nation to work and was partly doing that through massive construction projects. And the Lincoln Tunnel is the one that we're going to focus in on here. The Lincoln Tunnel connecting New Jersey with Manhattan. Actually, there was some planning that was already taking place when the Depression started, and the federal government took it over and got much of it built. Well, folks, think about this. So here's a piece of Commonwealth that's owned by the people that live in New Jersey and New York. Imagine how much individual wealth has been facilitated, has been created, has been motivated, has been generated, has been inspired by the fact that there is this easy, and relatively inexpensive access back and forth between these large populations. How much cultural exchange has there been? How many romances have been enabled? Right? On any measure of value, is there anybody out there who's able to estimate the value that has been created by that Commonwealth? I'm guessing it's incalculable how much value has been created by that Commonwealth. Now that we have this understanding of what Commonwealth can be, that we invest in it and we get marvelous returns and we share those returns, we all get the returns and each of us get those returns from the Commonwealth. Now that we've got that mindset, now let's talk about public schools. Now let's have a discussion about how we should be investing in them. Now let's have a discussion about how important they are for their community that they serve. Now let's hope that greater support and appreciation for the support of public schools might emerge if we bring different perspectives to the idea. Here's another example of how the language of creative populism can have significant impact. I think that universal guaranteed incomes are inevitable. It's not my job to guess if they're 5 years from now or 15 years from now, but I think widespread universal guaranteed incomes where citizens get a guaranteed stipend, I think it's inevitable, and here's why I think it's inevitable. I think businesses will discover it's in their best interest to support a UGI because between AI and other office automation investments, and considering that labor costs are the largest single cost for virtually every company that I can imagine, business owners are going to be highly motivated to become more profitable by trying to reduce those labor costs. And there's all these tools now that will make it very possible for them to reduce their labor costs. Well, folks, at some point, what's going to happen is these now highly, highly profitable companies, because they're so profitable because they don't have to pay anybody, what they're going to discover is that they have eliminated so many jobs that the market's purchasing power has seriously eroded. They won't have any place to sell their highly profitable goods and services until they get some money back into people's pockets. So I believe, again, the businesses will find it's in their best self-interest to support a universal basic income, a universal guaranteed income. Well, here's the piece that creative populism can impact, and that is that if leaders, political, social, community leaders, before UGI comes along, makes a big embrace of how important it is for us all to be creative and entrepreneurial and helps everyone, all of us, grow our creative and our entrepreneurial qualities, then when UGI comes along, folks, it's not just going to be a necessary welfare program. Instead, it can be talked about in terms of, oh, now let's invest in all this wonderful creative talent that has been generated so that there'll be this great bottoms-up self-organized renaissance from the grassroots. And as a populist, that just makes me so very, very happy that leadership would appreciate the value of getting ahead of UGI so that when UGI arrives, holy mackerel, there's this great uplift by all, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom when a little bit of money is added to folks who have got the time now to do what they love to do. One more segment, folks. Come on back, and I'll appreciate that you have.
You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius with Carl Nordgren. Welcome back to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Here's your host, Carl Nordgren.
Welcome back. Thanks for coming back. We've been talking about how can we spark our political imaginations. Do the ideas captured in creative populism have a role that they can be used to help us think differently, take new perspectives on how we consider old problems that politics have just made worse? Before I get into our final segment, I just really want to make sure that I make this announcement that on this evening, this afternoon, 4 o'clock this afternoon on the 26th, right, at 4 o'clock at Golden Fig Books, I will be introducing a wonderful short story writer named Ken Wetherington. You'll find the information on chapelborough.com's website's events calendar. Ken will be reading from his collections of short stories at Golden Fig at 4 o'clock. I will give a brief introduction. Look forward to, if you're a listener of the show and you're out there, please introduce yourself. I look forward to meeting you. Ken's a wonderful writer, and I look forward to listening to him read some of his better stories, some of his best stories, excuse me. So one last thought about how creative populists' language could impact business, and it's the topic of, and what a wonderful thing to contemplate, that we could be a nation that could be the first one ever to achieve a sustainable abundance, right? Sustainable is a banner for some of us politically. Abundance represents, you know, the primary fight for personal freedom and market dynamics. Creative populism gives us the opportunity to bring these two contrary ideas together and talk about a sustainable abundance for us all. The economic models exist, right? The economic models like the circular economy or sustainable capitalism, those economic models exist. Creative populism isn't offering a new economic model. What creative populism offers are the behaviors and the attitudes and the approaches to life that make it so much more likely that these alternative economic models can be successful. For instance, one of the very first creative ideas that spawned creative populism was the idea that being generous is being generative. I found it to be true all throughout my entrepreneurial life that when I was generous with the market, they were generous with me. When I was generous with employees, They were generous with us. Generosity is so very, very frequently met by generosity. Generosity is generative and it is sustainable and it doesn't run out. Another place where creative populism offers some insights into how we could make sustainable abundance occur, or even anything approaching it, is in the proper use of language. What are we trying to accomplish? For instance, when an opportunity comes along in any economic system, when an opportunity comes along, aren't we inclined usually here in the United States to say, I wonder how I can take advantage? I wonder how I can take advantage of this opportunity. I've said that myself many, many times. What I've been trying to say now is when an opportunity comes along, how can I create advantage from this opportunity, right? Taking advantage suggests I'm going to take the best for me and leave the rest for you. That would certainly be taking advantage of an opportunity. Creating advantage from the opportunity is I'm going to cultivate it. I'm going to develop it. I'm going to nurture it. I'm going to help it be the best version, the most productive version of itself it can be. I'm going to invite people in to share this, to work on this with me. That would be a create advantage approach. And then I don't think we should undervalue how important it is for leadership to just simply stand up and deliver the story that says, either I've known it all along and I'm just now going to act on it, or I've recently had an epiphany and now I'm going to act on it. But folks, I see you. I see my constituency as wonderfully creative and entrepreneurial people, ready to produce, ready to create, ready to grow. And I pledge myself this point going forward, says our political leader, I pledge myself to have that understanding of you, my seeing of you. And folks, we love to be seen at our very, very best. And that's one favor the leader is already giving us. Boy, when a leader stands up, a political leader, business leader, societal leader stands up and says, I see you. I see you as these wonderful, creative, and entrepreneurial people. And I'm going to do all I can to help you cultivate it, help you use that, help you benefit from it, help you create advantage of these wonderful qualities that you've got. Just telling those stories serves important leadership purposes. Because again, we just love to be seen this way. When I'm in a workshop and I tell people about how we're all born creative geniuses and give a little bit of research support for it, the room changes. People are living into that. They look at each other with a look in their eye like, oh my gosh, I'm in a room full of creative geniuses. And I tell them, boy, next time you go into another room, you're going to be walking into a room filled with creative geniuses. To see us that way, to be reminded that that's who we are, is itself a great service. I hope to see you today at 4 o'clock at Golden Fig to listen to Ken Wetherington read short stories. And I hope you have a wonderful week. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius with Carl Nordgren.